You are listening to the Myth TV Cast. Welcome to another exciting episode of the Myth TV Cast. My name's Pat Davila. With me is Dan Fry.
How you doing, Pat?
How's it going, Dan? It's been I just talked to you not too long ago.
Yeah, not too long ago. How about that?
If anybody knows, we recorded the last episode and this episode back to back on the same night. We figure we try something a little different and see how it goes with the recording schedule. I know it just seems that like lately we've been kind of slacking off and everything. You know, we want to do the 2-week schedule, but sometimes it's tough to do with, you know, family and work and everything. So we'll try this. Maybe we could do these sporadically and just make things a little easier. So what's new with you, Dan? You got some things you wanted to talk about, right?
Yeah, I've been doing a little digging around on the back end of Myth TV, and what I kind of wanted to talk about is Myth TV. The Myth protocol, there's an actual server running, and Myth XML. I've been looking at this because I've been trying to come up with different ways to get access to the data that's in the back end, and I was trying to go down different routes, see how like Myth Web worked when it was showing all the information, and how how the processes, you know, the back end processes seem to be communicating and stuff like that. So that's kind of what I wanted to talk about. I was looking at, like I said, Myth Web, and the it's strictly just a straight web application. So I mean, it's making a connection to the database. I believe it's a mixture of both Perl and Python running back there. So depending upon which page you're on, you'll probably find a different you know type of technology talking to the back end. Myth TV provides bindings for Perl, Python, for PHP. I think I saw that there's a Java binding out there, but it's a few revisions old. I don't believe it's being maintained anymore. So I was looking for all of this, and I came across Myth XML. I was actually talking to some of the. I was in IRC one night, you know, on the Myth developers IRC, and they were kind of pointing me to Myth XML because I wanted to find a way that was, you know, not tied to any platform or anything like that. For you know, getting access to the data, and this is what they pointed me to. I wanted to tell everybody about a package that's installed. It's not something that's running by default. There is an actual web application that's installed, you know, in each Myth install that will allow you to get access to all this. And I want to tell everybody where it's at. So give me one second here.
You're killing the show, man.
This web application actually allows you to go in and execute all of these Myth XML calls that can be made. They're all REST based. They appear to be REST based, but they allow you to make calls against the back end. And it allows you to retrieve data. So if you want to retrieve your court recording information, you want to retrieve stuff about your music, your videos, your program guide, you can specify different parameters like a start time and an end time and how many channels you want to show. This application allows you to do that. I guess I should take a step back here real quick and talk about Myth XML in general. Myth XML is a server that runs on the master backend. So our last episode, when we were talking to Robert, he had mentioned port 6544. If you go through your Myth TV setup, you'll see this port number listed in there. You can change it to be whatever you want to. But this is an actual HTTP server running that allows for these REST communications to take place. And this allows you to make these calls and get the responses back, and they provide you, you know, well-formed XML. And now there is an application, a test application that's installed if anybody's interested in learning about this.
Sounds interesting. So basically, this is a way for you to access functionality within MITTV through a web-based, well, not necessarily web-based, but XML configuration file, passing commands back and forth in XML.
Right. And you, what you would do is you would from, say, either from the command line or from the browser or some other method of making an HTTP call, you would be making, you can do HTTP gets and HTTP posts. For anybody out there who's a web developer, they'll know the differences between those types of things. But the web application, and let me tell you, just on my box, I'm running a Mythbuntu box, but and the actual overall location may vary. But if I look under /user/share/doc/mythtv-backend/contrib/development, you're going to find a package under there called Myth XML Test. It's capital M Myth, capital X, capital L, or M, capital L, capital T, and then test. What I did was I symlinked this into my /var/www directory, and this allows you to go and then, just as you would your Myth web interface, it allows you to run this backend test client that allows you to connect to any number of boxes that you happen to have. So I have two backends on my system. At the very top of the page, the first thing that you do is type in a server. So I can query the master backend, I can query a secondary backend, it doesn't really matter which box that I'm on. And this allows me then to make these calls. And one of the first things that you'll see when you get into this application, and I'm going there right now just so I can tell everybody the correct commands that you're going to be making. The first thing that you can see when you go to this is that you can get just the regular old status that you see on Myth Web. So there is a page in here that actually mimics the status that you would see on the regular Myth Web interface. And so long as you type the server in, it will make a call against port 6544, which is that HTTP server that's running there, and it will show you the same exact information that you'll see on your backend server. You'll see your encoders, whether or not anyone is recording anything, your up and coming job listing, anything like that. You'd see any jobs that have completed, you know, all of that, the amount of storage space you have left available, all that basic general information out there. When you look at across this interface, you see a number of tabs, and I'm going to concentrate specifically on the Myth XML tab, but there is a couple other tabs on here, and I won't get into them. The first option when you click on Myth XML is you can get a service description. When you execute this command, it actually gives you back a listing in XML of all of the services that this particular web service, you know, provides. So you could, in a sense, think of it in an application terms, query this backend and have it tell you what application calls it can make, and then somehow, you know, index those, put them into, say, other forms of methods, like, you know, it tells you your input methods, your output methods, all of that information, and generate an interface that allows you to do something with this data. So I'm going to click on here, let's say, get host. And when I execute the get host command, and all right, this let me switch browsers here. It doesn't seem to like this in Chrome for some reason, so I'll switch over to Firefox.
Yeah, in general, Chrome is great, but sometimes once in a blue moon, you might hit something that doesn't like it.
Yeah, this is one of those.
So I guess the reason why they wrote this is a way for you to write a web-based application that has all the features and functions of Myth, right?
It's more than that. I believe this is also used in more of the inner communications between a lot of the back-end components. So I think between servers, so between, say, master back-end and secondary back-end, you'll see that they can actually query and post jobs to one another and whatnot. And let me go back here.
So this is the secret sauce, basically, is what you're saying.
Yeah, this is kind of how the whole, you know, all of the communication is taking place. Now, we all know that the database sits on the master backend. There's going to be a database on the secondary backend that's going to be a bit of a lighter version of the master backend. There's not going to be any databases that exist. At least I don't believe so on any of the front ends. And so they're going to all be querying the master backend in this manner. So let me go back to my get host example. So I'm looking at the get host. Now, since I've actually performed upgrades and done a number of these over a number of releases of Mythbuntu, I have a number of names in here that no longer exist on my network. So right there, it's telling me that I at some point should go in and try to clean up the database a little bit, you know, because I see some, you know, my desktop machine is for some reason connected to it, you know, and then there's what I used to call my master backend. That's still listed in here, and that's been gone for a long time, because I think I changed that after the last time my board died on the master backend, and I had to reinstall everything. But let's look at here at the program. So get program details. I don't want the program details. Get recorded. That's what I want. So when I click on get recorded in this interface, I can either select, you know, descending, you know, true or false, and when I click the button, right now I have a list of everything that is currently out there. I currently have 39 programs out there. It gives me a date that it's as of, so it's right now down to the millisecond. You know, so today's the 16th of July, you know, it's 10:32:51, okay? So it tells me the version that we're running on, the version of MythTV, the backend protocols that we're running on. And then I have a list of recordings, which contains programs, and each program contains channel information and recording information, and then they also have other attributes like the title, the subtitle, the file size, you know, the category that it's in. You know, here you might see things like the group, the recording group. So if it's a live TV recording that still hasn't deleted itself yet, or if it's it's in like the default recording group, and whatever profiles you happen to have set up like that. You can get down to like the series ID that the back end has. So say for instance, Chuck is going to have series ID, you know, 010, for instance. You know, I would see that version of Chuck on here, it has a back end series ID associated with it in this interface. So you can see that there's a lot of information that you can get. You can get a list of everything that's expiring. You can have something generate preview images, and you can even tell it to say, you know, give me a preview image for this episode and start it 5 seconds in and give it to me, you know, generate me that preview for in a like a 60 by 60 pixel map or something like that. It gives you a ton of information and ways to access all of this information and with any programming language that you can think of. And so long as you can parse the XML, you can open up an HTTP connection to it. You can parse the XML, and then you have free reign with it. It allows you to do quite a bit of information, or quite a bit with this backend, and allows you to get all access to all that information. And so what I've been finding is that I can go in here, you know, query this stuff as I like, just as I would say I'm connecting to a database or connecting in some other means to get this to get access to this information. I have access to this immediately from wherever I am, and I can just so long as I can get access to the backend server over the network or say through my firewall or something like that, I can write my own programs to go in and see what this data, see what's on the box, see what the box is doing. I believe there are methods in here that you can also send instructions to it, much like you can on the telnet port. Where you can telnet and say do the mythnet control, where you can control your box over the network by sending telnet commands, and you can say, you know, play, pause, that type of stuff. Much like what mythmote does. But it allows you to have access to this back-end data that you might not otherwise be able to get access to.
So from what you're telling me, it sounds pretty powerful. Sounds like you could do.
Oh yeah, yeah. There is a lot. I mean, I can tell you like connection information from here. So long as it actually requires a PIN number. So this is when they added that new PIN number, you know, in one of the last few releases or so. You can change the settings. If you know the setting that you want to change, you can get a list of the settings by the key and the host name and whatnot. And then you can even, you know, send updates to those settings back there. So if you know that you have something that you need to change.
I was going to say, the way you're describing it, whether or not this was a security risk. But it sounds like, you know, at least they got the PIN number in there so that you're able to have some semblance of control over
it. Exactly.
If you didn't have that, right, it would right. be pretty you, dangerous.
Oh, yeah, exactly. But, I mean, granted, this also this app isn't turned on by default anywhere, so that's why when I link it into my you know, var www directory, I can actually get to it, say, through my firewall or something like that. But this, again, this is just a test application, and typically people don't expose port 6544, you know, on their firewall, so they you know, it's not so much as a security risk, but unless you enable it, you know, and you can always access it directly, you know, on the same machine, you know, just by navigating to that directory that I mentioned, launching the index.html file in there, and you'd see what's see the whole interface in a browser.
Well, that's good to know that it's not on by default.
Yeah, right. But this I thought was a pretty invaluable tool that people out there may or may not be aware of. And more to the point, the actual HTTP server running back there that can tell you all the processes that it can do, as well as allow you to execute these commands so that you can pull this information in any way that you like.
So basically, you can write an application on any language, on any platform, as long as it communicates, you know, with the XML. You could pretty much
over HTTP.
Over HTTP, you could pretty much do it with anything.
Yep. And I don't know of an of a programming language that really doesn't do that nowadays. Yeah, all your main ones.
That's,
you know,
standard
your
Java's,
your Pythons,
yeah,
your Perls. Yeah.
Well, all the web stuff uses XML heavily, you know. Maybe we should just step back a little bit. What's the difference between HTML and XML?
HTML is more or less for, it's a sub, well, there's the, let's see, what was it called? I used to know, like, this whole lineage here. HTML, or HTML is a subset of SGML, and they're all XML. XML is a way of having tags that are meaningful that describe the type of data that you're looking at. So if I have a tag called title, inside that tag, I'll have some type of a text that to me means it's a title for something, but the actual document itself is describing to whatever happens to be reading it, you as an individual, a browser, it tells it to know that this is the title. Okay, when I see that this is the title and I'm a browser, I'm going to put this in my, you know, the top, you know, title bar of my page, for instance. So the XML is a way of describing the data, you know, meaningfully to you, the developer, or to the application, to the problem domain that you're trying to solve. It's a way of describing that information as well as providing that data with those key tags that are inside of there.
Right, where HTML was basically, you had some words on a page, on a web page. The HTML was just telling the web browser how to present that data that's on that web page, you know, fonts and sizes,
right,
and whatnot, colors or whatever. Where XML is metadata. It's information about the information embedded in within the file.
Exactly.
And in the way my understanding of XML is that different industries have provided their own, like, standards and APIs for their own specifics for what they're using it for. For instance, the banking industry might have their own set of XML tags that they use, that, you know, for required for the type of data that they use. The pharmaceutical industry might have their own set, and so on and so forth. Right.
Right. Right. And you can look at HTML as just another subset like that. It describes what a web page should look like in a browser.
So basically, XML is become a way of, besides presenting data, it's a way for programs to communicate and know how to deal with that data.
Yes, and they could be running in completely different languages. You don't need to bind to, say, some remote object like with Java and EJBs, you know, enterprise Java beans. You used to have to bind to a remote, a remote object and a local or home object, and they'd have to be able to talk to each other over a specific protocol. You know, now it doesn't matter if I'm running Java or Python or Perl or even some, you know, like ASP or .NET, you know, web service or something along that line that can produce for me XML. I don't care what languages I'm trying to consume it in.
Right,
I can,
or what platform,
all I know is
or
that
whatever.
I can connect to that service, you know, over standard, you know, HTTP protocols, and query that back-end information with the type of resource that I'm requesting, and it can send back to me just standard XML.
Right. So say you conceivably you can have data being read by a COBOL program on a mainframe, you know, accessing a DB2 database, talking to a web server that's running on a Linux box running Apache, you know, and talking to an Android phone.
You name it. Yeah. I mean, any of those scenarios are completely possible.
So this is purely a web-based thing right now, right? That's the realm what we're talking about.
So that port 644, if you go into your master backend and you run the MythTV setup, you'll look on the general tab, and one of the first, you know, few pages in there where you have to specify your IP address for, you know, the master backend, you're also going to see the two ports on there. I believe there's 6543 and then there's 6544. 6543, I believe, is the telnet port that's the status port. Telnet port just runs over the typical, 25 or something like that?
23, something like that. I think
23, yeah. That particular port, I believe, is just for being able to get status updates from the master backend. The 6544 is actually bound to a web server that's running inside of MythTV that runs over the Myth protocol, which is the I assuming it would be something like, instead of HTTP, you're talking, you know, myth:// you know, whatever. I've actually seen this protocol being executed in like XBMC with a Myth plugin that it has. It's making a call to MythTV using that type of a protocol. And I could be wrong about that. I'm kind of just recollecting, you know, something that I tried, you know, quite a while ago. But that HTTP server is what's, you know, connecting to, say, the master, you know, backend MySQL database and whatever programs are being used to generate that. It's then producing for you the XML.
Right. So let me.
And that's what gets served back to the calling program.
So this is all really interesting information, you know, that I wasn't aware of. So Dan, tell us why you're looking into this whole backend and web services and the whole MythTV protocol. Why are you interested in this?
Well, I'm looking to do something with it. I don't know if I'm ready to say anything yet.
Well, it's up.
You're kind of putting me on the spot here, Pat.
It's up to you if you want to divulge what you're doing.
Well, I am very close to creating a streaming server. I should say a streaming application for Android phones.
So being able to stream your Myth recordings to mobile devices.
Exactly. There's going to be a number of components that are going to need to be in place first, and I would like to actually start working on some of the MythWeb stuff to see if I could. I know of some places where I think I could streamline some of this stuff, because there are streaming capable, you know, scripts inside of MythWeb already that'll do, you know, MPEG-4, that'll do AS. I'm not sure what ASX is. Is that I've seen it before. It seems to work with, like, if you connect to like a Windows machine and connect from like media player to that, you know, it'll stream it. There are streams in there, you know, that on the fly will convert to Flash if you're going right through the MythWeb. All of the recording information is out there that you need to have. I would like to maybe, you know, look at doing some JSON, you know, stuff, because JSON is a little bit more lightweight than the XML stuff. But it will ultimately stream a 3D.
For people who don't know, what's JSON?
JSON is a JavaScript object notation. If you're familiar with JavaScript, it is a way for, maybe I want to say, like, pseudo creating objects inside of JavaScript. Since JavaScript is not a typed language, this allows you to, say, mimic, you know, data structures and stuff like that. It's very much more powerful than that, though, and an element could actually be a whole, you know, JavaScript script, or it could just be something as simple as a Boolean value, and this could all be wrapped up together inside of a, you know, a set of things, which is consists of a JSON object. It's very easily transportable over the network, and most languages, especially now Java, which is what Android, you know, uses, or JavaScript, you know, they all can seem to talk JSON in a much, you know, quicker method than say parsing XML into Java objects and whatnot. So there's some refinements that I want to do, you know, but I think going forward, just as an initial launch type thing, I have this idea in mind to use a Darwin streaming server, converting the files to 3GP. This is where it gets kind of kludgy in a sense, but it all works. I've tried out all the pieces, you know, individually, and they all work. I'm more or less refining the Android 8, you know, interface at this point. Pat, you're going to test it out for me, and I got a couple other people in mind who are going to do some testing.
Definitely
going to
help you out as much
as I can. And then hopefully get this out there. And then as a first release, I think this is going to be a good first shot. And then we'll eventually, hopefully I can get some of these refinements made into MythWeb to be able to handle all of that on the back end with no intermediary, say converting, you know, this H.264 file to a 3GP file and whatnot. I'd be able to do all that right on the fly.
So you're saying basically your idea is that this is going to go into MythWeb, or is it going to be a separate plugin that's going to work with MythWeb?
Well, like I said, it's a bit kludgy at this point, because there needs to be a script, you know, a user job that you run on the back end machine
right.
to convert the media. There needs to be a separate streaming server on there. Streaming server's default port is 554. You can switch that to be anything that you want to, but that's I guess a typical streaming server port that you can see. Plus that's TCP. There's also a number of UDP ports that you can also stream over. Likewise, you can force it to go over port 80, but there's issues with that as well, because you can't have anything else bound to port 80, and most web servers are bound to port 80. So there's still some things that I'm working out, but I hope to have at least preliminary application out there, you know, hopefully in the next couple of weeks the next couple of weeks. Like I said, the interface is very close to being complete, and at this point, I think even just on my local network, I should be able to start streaming content to either the emulator or to an actual device, you know, very, very soon.
So basically, this is going to be like a sling box for a mobile device.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking when I first sat down to start trying this out. Actually a few weeks ago they announced that there was already going to be a Sling player for Android phones, but there's nothing doing this for Myth TV. So I figured this is the perfect opportunity to first one, learn Android programming, since I already am a Java developer anyway. This was not a very difficult task to do. Getting, you know, the interface refinements down, getting the back-end scripts, you know, refinements down, getting the streaming server stuff, you know, down, getting all of these pieces together, and they all work. I've actually written like two or three, little Android apps that just test this out, where I just point to my streaming server and it launches video and it works fine. It works better than fine. I've messed around with just trying out different interfaces, you know, and learning how Android does a lot of its things, you know, I guess trying to get as low a level as I possibly can. I learned a lot of stuff about FFmpeg too that I wasn't quite familiar with before as well, and so now that I have these scripts that are ready, I've got the streaming server ready, I've got the interface just almost ready, you know, I should be able to have this out, you know, sometime very soon.
Now, you said you're going to stream to 3GP, which is a video codec for mobile devices,
yes.
Right? What kind of resolution, rates are we talking about, huh?
Well, you are getting... Let me get the script open for you here.
I guess the idea is when you're doing streaming is, you know, you want to get the quality good enough so that it's watchable but small
exactly.
enough that it streams fairly economical,
right.
Even if you don't have, like, the fastest connection.
Right, and I wanted to go with something that was more friendly to 3G, so that you would be able to theoretically stream this, say, through your firewall, you know, connect, make sure you have the right ports exposed and whatnot, but through your firewall to your phone, not running on Wi-Fi, but running on 3G. The 3GP codec is suited to this. H.264 and MPEG-4, which is what the other two streaming codecs that Android supports, are a bit heavyweight, I think, in my mind. H.264 definitely, because the files can be, you know, 2 and 3 times as large. I can take a half hour show that'll run about what H.264 four gigabytes worth of data, and it knocks down to about 100 megabytes, and that'll be much more friendly to your bandwidth, considering all of the bandwidth capping stuff that they're proposing, and not so much from your own personal connection. You know, I know some people who are who have hit those limits and have been warned and whatnot that they've been hitting those limits. But, you know, AT&T and capping the amount of data that you can download, you know, to, what is it, like 2 gigabytes or something like that on a monthly basis. You know, I wanted something that was going to be friendly to all of those connections. So if you're out and using Wi-Fi and you don't care about your home connection, you know, you should run fine. But if it's those times when you don't happen to have, you know, that Wi-Fi connection available, and you still want to be able to sit there and stream something to your phone, I wanted to make sure that you could still at least get it, the quality as good as possible for that connection that you're on.
What kind of resolution are you talking about here? 320x240 or?
Let me see what it is. There is a spec. Yeah, I actually have 352x288. There is a spec. I was reading this in some Android documentation. There was a few resolutions that it supports. One of them, this was one of them, I believe. One was like 172x200 or 300. I forget what it was. But this one seemed to play on at least the one device that I selected. The nice thing about this is that you'd be able to configure this if you find that you have something you want a little higher or a little lower. Resulting sizes will be reflected by that, you know.
If you have a bigger device, I know the older Android devices, you know, the videos was like the old iPhone, 320x240. You know, which is decent quality. Yeah. I mean, I have a Nexus, and that resolution looks decent, you know. For other video, I ramp it up because it's got a higher resolution. But, you know, you want to hit the least common denominator on the low end. But being able to maybe go up to a higher quality and make it a flexible, something I guess you want to keep in the back of your mind going forward.
Exactly.
Once you get the basics
all
implemented.
The nice thing about this, too, is you can select between, it has two audio codecs as well that will also affect the size. There's a narrow band one, which gives you kind of like a one channel output, you know, but then there's also a wide band one, which would give you two channel output, and better quality. You know, I think the narrow band one is set to, like about what, 8,000 Hertz or something like that. I mean, I might be having that terminology wrong there. But it gives you a more hollow sound, you know. But you can go with the wideband one, which gives you a much better sound. So I mean, there is going to be some room for tweaking in here, so that you can get just the right, you know, quality that you want. I more or less want to be sure that I have the infrastructure in place, so that you can, one, get access to it from the phone, be able to initiate it from the phone through the listing that you're seeing there, and be able to have the back end serve out the content to you. So you can generate these files to be whatever size, you know, whatever size you feel is acceptable, and if you want to play around with these settings, you're more than welcome to, but you want to. I'm going with this as kind of like a lowest common denominator at this point.
Yeah, I mean, once you get everything all implemented and you get it all packaged up and working and everything, you can start you know, thinking about, you know, going up, you know, more powerful and higher resolution and bigger files and whatnot.
Exactly.
You know, increasing the quality, you know, for different codecs and whatnot, and, you know.
Sure. I mean, if you know you're only going to be, say you're only doing this, you only plan on doing this inside your house, you know, make those files as big as you want them to be, so you get as best quality as you possibly can. You're just going to be using your own local Wi-Fi network.
Yeah, I guess,
but
you know,
if you want to be outside the network.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're away somewhere. You say like you're on the road or something. You want to watch something quick.
Yeah.
Now,
So the video codec is going to be H.263. The audio codec is going to use the AMRM I'm sorry, the AMR narrowband is what I'm looking at first. The bit rate's 400K. The channels is 1. The audio bit rate is 12.2K. And I think the frame rate is what, about 13 frames per second.
Yeah, 13 is not too bad. I mean, you can keep that frame rate and go up to higher resolution, and it'll look fine.
Mm-hmm.
So this sounds cool. I know MythWeb has a thing in there where you can go into the recording sections and you can enable it so that you can watch in the browser, the videos streamed via Flash. Now,
yes.
My experience with that is, my current box, it's only powerful enough to be able to do that well with standard def recordings. With high def recordings, it stops and buffers. It's only smooth with standard def recordings. My box is only a 2 gigahertz dual core processor, my main myth box.
Right.
So I can understand why it does that.
And I have issue with that. Yeah, I have issue with that right now because I have multiple backends. If I try to initiate one that's on a backend that isn't necessarily exposed over the internet. So in other words, I don't have MythWeb, really running on my secondary backend. It's not like MythWeb isn't smart enough to look in the storage group on a secondary backend to pull the content. So in other words, stream the content from the secondary backend through the master backend, through the firewall, to my browser, wherever I happen to be.
So let me ask you, Dan, do you have a name that you're thinking of calling this thing?
Well, I was trying to mess with something with streaming or whatever, but I didn't want to be like MythStream or anything like that. And I also was thinking along the lines of something like a MythDroid, but that I didn't know if there was anything else out there currently with that name. I figured that it might be a pretty likely, choice for somebody. And considering this was strictly going to be for streaming, I wasn't going to try to control the back end or do anything like that. I was kind of playing off stream and
mobile streamer.
I'm going with MythFlow. And if I'm open to interpretation there, if anybody wants to propose any other name, then I'm gladly willing to entertain that. But for the time being, that's the development name for it.
Cool. Where are you going to put all your code, and what are you going to release this under?
It'll be GPL. It'll be out on. I'm going to put it out on the Google Code site, and I was really thinking, do I want to charge like a buck for it or something like that? But I'm like, nah, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah, first time.
I'm going to put it out there. I'm going to put out instructions for how to set up all of the pieces that are going to be in place. So it's nice because it has the wiki and all that kind of stuff. I want to put it out there and make it accessible to everybody. As the myth project itself is, they want it to be out there. It's accessible to everybody. I want this to be accessible to everybody with an Android phone. So.
Cool. All you need now is a phone that actually lets you install third-party applications in your Golden.
Exactly. But if I put it
because
in the
your
market,
wife has a motor
in the marketplace,
right?
Yeah, she has the backflip.
But that's on AT&T.
I've been testing with that.
AT&T like disabled. What is it? Third-party repos.
Yeah. Right.
But
that's why I'll put it in the marketplace, and that it shouldn't be an issue.
Does it let you put like the APK? APK is like the binary package. For Android apps?
Yeah, I haven't tried that, but what I can do is I enable USB development mode on it, and I can hook a USB line up to it and actually debug anything that I'm doing right on the phone inside of Eclipse.
Yeah, I mean,
so it allows me to do that.
It should, as long as you're able to put the APK on the file in a folder, you should be able to execute it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
And then once you get everything all ironed out and all packaged and everything, then you can put it out on the marketplace and whatnot for the client piece.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, that's what I'm planning on doing.
Cool.
Yeah, I'm not going to put it out there without going.
Got to come up with the QR code, man.
That amount of testing.
On your website, you got to generate, once you got everything all done, you got to generate a QR code. Those things are awesome, man.
Yep.
You have to go to like some of those Android application review sites, and they got the QR code. All you do is if you have a scanner application, you scan that, and it'll automatically open up your marketplace application, and it'll start downloading it for you. It's pretty awesome.
Oh, cool.
Yeah,
I'll have to check that out.
Oh, it's awesome, man. You never seen that done?
No,
it's one thing I like to show to like Apple users. Basically, what it is there's mm-hmm. applications that do scanning. One popular application on Android is called Shop Savvy, and basically what it is, it uses the camera.
Oh yeah, I've seen those types of apps.
Right,
yep.
it'll scan just a generic barcode off, say like a back of a book or something or a box. It'll go out and it'll tell you like what the price is for that application, either locally in a local store near you or on the web. There are other applications that do use the scanning technology too. And I forget the one mm-hmm. that I have, the generic one, but it's a barcode scanner. So what it is QR codes are like these stamp size barcodes. You know, they're like rectangular.
Yep.
And they're small.
Yeah, they got funky images in them.
Yeah, they're weird looking. And initially they were very popular, like in Japan, they were using them more than here. But with Android mm-hmm. becoming very popular, you're starting to see them. So what it is you can embed like a URL within that barcode. So what it is when an application's on the marketplace, it basically has it's basically a URL, an identifier, saying this is the name, you know, it's a file on whatever server. So
mm-hmm.
you can generate a QR code for an application that's sitting in the marketplace. You put that QR code on your website, okay? Someone sees it, mm-hmm. the application. You could talk about the application, and there's the QR code. You fire up your scanner program on your Android phone. You mm-hmm. scan that in. It'll automatically open up Marketplace, bring you to that thing, and then ask if you want to install it. It's awesome. Great little.
Oh, that's awesome.
It's really cool. It's really slick, and it's really cool.
Well, I will have to add that then.
Absolutely, QR code is definitely on the list of things.
I'll add that to the site then.
Yeah, it's cool.
Yeah.
So that's cool, man. I'm glad you have actually found the time to do all this stuff. You know, I wish I had the luxury of doing that myself, man. I would get involved more.
I mean, to be honest, you know, learning the Android programming language and stuff like that, I mean, it's all Java anyway. And I, like I said, I do Java development on a daily basis. You know, learning the little nuances and stuff like that, you know, it wasn't so bad. I mean, like laying out the, you know, the application and it is XML. Like we were talking about XML and HTML. It's very HTML like what they're doing. It's all
aren't all
know,
the configuration it, files and XML files. A lot of the most part,
like the layouts themselves, the layouts, like the actual interfaces that you see, like where you see things, lists of things or tables of things, they're all really XML. You can do them in code if you want to. You're not tied to using the XML.
Same thing with the myth menus on your myth box. When you fire up that menu, all that is an XML file. You know, when we talk about
the
how-tos for setting up the Hulu application within Myth TV.
Yep.
It's basically you open up your menu XML and you go there and you can edit it in any old editor and change it. That's what's nice about these things. They're just files and you go and you change them.
The XML files are, you know, I mean, if you're a programmer, you might be thinking, well, everything's XML, you know, that could parsing all the time, that could be kind of slow.
Yeah, it gets
tedious. What they actually do is they actually take these XML files, and when it's built, they compress the hell out of these things. They actually turn them into, you know, little objects themselves, and they're referenced, you know, in memory by there's one class, it's just called R. And in it contains references to all your layouts, your IDs of the objects that are on your pages, anything that you have that's considered drawable, any icons that you're using, any menus that you've set up, you know, especially icons, you know, on the menus and everything, or tabs across the top of the page that's on there. All that stuff is referenced by a memory location, and you just plug in this static code that comes inside it. And by static, I mean it never changes once it gets generated. You plug that into wherever you're using that in the code, you immediately have access to, say, a text box or a button or some other form element if you need to populate something or if you want to register that you've clicked on a button. You reference it by that code, and it's very, very tight, very, very lean, and you can do a whole heck of a lot with it.
It's cool.
Likewise, you can very easily, you know, say, give me higher resolution versions of these images, or if I'm on this device, or if I'm on, a much more lower end device, I can say, give me the lower resolution ones, and a lot of it can change even, you know, from when you rotate it from portrait to landscape. I mean, there's a whole slew of things that you can do there. Let alone access all of like the Google APIs and this and that, you know. So I mean, if I wanted to say add into this that I'm tweeting, you know, at this particular time and I'm at this location based upon my geolocation, you know, through the Google API and stuff like that, and dropping something on. But I mean, I can do all of that if I wanted to. But I mean, this doesn't really fit for this application. But you know, it's there. It's possible.
Yeah, you can get pretty crazy with some of the capabilities.
Oh yeah.
It's interesting now, you know, I've been running Android, you know, I've had an Android phone for, I don't know, a year and like maybe 3 months, 4 months. And the amount of applications that are available, it's crazy now. It's become very mature.
Oh, yeah. I think I saw today that they just passed over 1 billion downloads and they were at over 100,000 applications now. However, Google, I think, retracted that and said it's only 70,000. But still, they're getting close. I think 2 months ago we were talking how they had over 50,000. And in that short time frame, you know, I mean, they've jumped from 50 to possibly 100, but more likely 70,000 applications.
There's a lot of applications, and it's moving pretty quickly. I mean, granted, a lot of those applications are probably in fart applications, but I'm sure there's less of them than what's on iTunes for the iPhone. You know, but it's becoming very mature, and the amount of stuff that's on there, it's pretty cool. And what you could do with it. And it's good stuff, man. I highly recommend it to anybody who's into phones. And it's basically a little Linux, you know, computer.
And it's exactly. There's a native interface, too, that you can program. And I believe they're opening up to being able to do Python and even some Perl, maybe.
You can do Python. There's like a Python Adobe scripting Flex interface, but it's kind of limited.
Yeah.
It doesn't have... You don't get the full hooks that you do with the native you know, Java Android offshoot that they have. There is also a native SDK, which I think is C, I think it is. C or C++.
Yeah.
I forget.
Yeah. But I believe that like Adobe Air, like you'll be able to write an Air application, host it on a web server, and be able to access it, you know, natively over your Android phone if you can't do it already, you know. At least in I think 2.2 or an update to 2.2, you'll be able to do that.
Yeah, I mean, we harp on how much we hate Flash, but it's, you know, with Android 2.2, which is called Froyo, it's pretty nice that you're able to do Flash playback. And it works, for the most part, it works pretty well.
Right.
I can go to a website and there's Flash and I can play it and whatnot. Interestingly enough, when I first got the update, I was able to go onto the Hulu website and actually watch content on there on my phone. But Hulu, you know, got wind that Android people were watching stuff on there, and they basically disabled it. If, you know, they put a little detection script in there to see that it's coming from a mobile device.
Why do they care? I mean, why do they care?
Because they're going to come up with their own application, probably charge for it.
Yeah,
that's why they're doing that.
Yeah, but when we were talking to Robert from, you know, on one of the MythCore devs, you know, he was saying that so long as you're playing it in a browser, it's being played on their site. You know, why do they care if it's being played on an Android phone in a browser as compared to being on a PC in a browser?
You know, it's pretty ridiculous.
Doesn't make any sense.
They don't care about the bandwidth. You know, it's serving out to a client. It doesn't make a difference where it is. It's not their network, so what do they care?
Exactly.
Yeah, well, you know how it is. You know, they're looking to make money on the side. They have like this this Hulu upgradable pay service. Yeah, Hulu Plus.
Hulu Plus.
They're looking to make money. That's what it is. And there's even talk that they're going to have a Netflix streaming application on Android too pretty soon. Supposedly.
They had a job posting for an Android developer.
So. Yeah, yeah. And then actually during the Google I/O conference when they were showing the Flash stuff, I actually saw what looked like to be a Netflix application on some of their screenshots. So something's going on there, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm glad it's opening up, and there's no reason why if they have an application on Android, it's not on Linux by default, you know. So I'm glad it's progressing, and it's interesting stuff. But I got to find some time to actually get into the Android stuff, and I like to learn more about the Myth TV stuff if I have the time to learn it. It's fascinating stuff, and you really get an opportunity to grow appreciation for what the Myth TV developers have done. You know, it's pretty amazing. You know, it's an open source application.
Yeah,
and it just compares so well to like commercial applications. Have you been listening to that HTPC podcast? Which is
I have been, and I don't know. I think I still want to talk to these guys.
I do,
you know,
too.
At some point, maybe we should try to do like a little roundtable type thing.
Interestingly enough, one of the guys that's on there, Jerry Jones, he just started an Android application with Gadget Guru, who we know.
Oh yeah,
it's called Android Buffet, and they've got like two episodes out. So you know, you got Gadget Guru, who's a Linux guy, and then they got Jerry Jones, who's the Microsoft HTV dude. You know. It's just an interesting thing, you know.
I've been listening to them and the stuff that some of the stuff that they've been talking about. It just seems too difficult. Like what they're trying to do, you know. They're either making it more difficult or I'm not quite sure what it is yet. I still haven't quite gotten a handle on what it is that they're doing.
The last couple episodes, they were talking about Windows Home Server. And it sounds like all the stuff that they're talking about, you can do in Linux fairly easy. And it sounds like they get hung up on like the hardware aspect. I mean, these guys are putting together these insane RAID arrays and whatnot. You know, I have a NAS box.
10 recorders and
crazy setups inside virtualization and all this other stuff. I mean, crazy setups, you know, and they're doing this on Windows boxes that need to be rebooted every couple of days.
Well, the last one that I listened to, I think they talked about that the Windows Home Server, like there is the potential for it to wipe all of your data if you would happen to reinstall the operating system.
Yeah. There's also, they've talked
to me
about
in my,
go ahead.
Yeah. I was going to say, in my mind, you know, that is unacceptable by any means. If there is even the potential for it to overwrite all of your data just to reinitialize the RAID array that happens to be behind there, there is something wrong. There is something going on there that is not set up correctly.
or
programmed correctly on the Windows Home Server.
Well, to me, what was insane, what I heard was they were talking about getting beta versions of Windows Home Media, Windows Home Server. Whatnot, the operating system.
Yeah.
And when they go to a final release, there's no upgrade path to go from the beta to the final release.
Yeah.
What the hell, man?
What is up with that?
What the hell? You're building, like, you know, these ridiculous arrays with, like, you know, 30 terabytes of information, and you got to do, like, wipe everything out and rebuild everything? Come on.
Right.
Mickey Mouse crap, you know? But I'd love to talk to them about it, though.
I do. I want to. I know Patrick Archibald and Gadget Guru both had an episode. They were both together on an episode with them, and you know, they were trying to show them the differences and show them actually how easy it is, you know, to do some of the stuff that they were doing. But I think the impression that I got from the host then overall was that they didn't seem like it would be something they would ever even be willing to touch.
They're kind of like bag on Linux whenever they can. I notice. I've heard them make different people.
Guys?
There's a couple different guys.
The other guy's name.
They make comments, you know, about Linux and whatnot, and it's kind of silly.
He said he was going to try it. And I would be glad to, you know, to sit with him, you know, like this, like on our Asterisk box or something like that, and walk him through the different things if he has any issues with anything, because he said he's got a partition set up just to try out something like, you know, Mythbuntu or one of the other ones. So I'll put that out there. I will sit there with him and we'll see, you know, how difficult it actually is. And it's not going to be that difficult. I mean, we've talked before, you know, we can get the machine set up in, you know, 20 minutes or so, you know, 20, 30 minutes, you know, have a base install. So,
yeah, well, teacher's on, I guess, but yeah, I'd like to talk to these people.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And get an open line of communication and just to see what the other guy's doing and vice versa.
Exactly.
You know, just to see how they do it.
Yeah.
And it's good to learn from other people.
I mean, I was kind of thrown also by, like, the amount of separate plugins that you need to go out and find to get Home Theater working or Windows Media Center working. That kind of threw me, because I thought a lot of that was supposed to all be built in, but I guess it's not. You know, maybe it is that, you know, on the Myth side, we just do a better job at packaging all that stuff up together, or I guess legally we can, and maybe legally they can't on the Windows Media side. I don't know, but still, you have to go out and buy all this stuff too, I believe, whereas, you know, one of the nice benefits of Myth TV is that it's all free. So
yeah, it seems some of them run Windows Home Media Edition, and some of them run Sage TV, And Sage TV is its own separate application that you put on, you know, base install, whatever. And
right. And that runs on Linux and Windows.
They do have a
Mac,
Linux
version,
too,
right?
And I actually approached them to get like a copy to do a review on, and they never responded to me. I wouldn't mind just to try it out.
Is
like
it
on
pay
a,
for?
Yeah, they charge for everything up the wazoo.
Oh.
Yeah, it's a full commercial product. So you basically have to pay for the OS, and then you have to pay for the application separately. And then they also have extenders that you can run on there. You can buy hardware, which are like similar to the Popcorn Era box, where you could buy it from them and it connects automatically.
Oh, okay.
And does all that stuff. But it's interesting to see what they're up to and how they're doing it differently and whatnot. You know, and likewise, you know, the MIT-TV guys, the developers, they should see what, you know, XBMC guys are doing, what the Boxy guys are doing. It's good to see what everybody's doing and try to, you know, improve upon what everybody else has. You know, you can learn from other people, and why not?
Exactly.
You know, if you see something that's great, implement something similar to it, you know? You know, that also goes back to the whole issue of software patents. You know, in the United States, we have software patents, and honestly, I think the software patent system here really needs to be redone and revamped and cleaned up. Mm-hmm. It's really an outdated system, you know? You know, patents back in the early days, you know, they were made to protect inventors so that they were able to have enough time to develop a product and without the fear of, you know, competition stealing what they have before they got to the market.
Right.
You know, nowadays, you know, software has become a commodity, you know. It's not really, you know, that innovative anymore, you know. It's pretty much the same stuff and, you know, people just come up with new, slightly different ways of doing it, you know. It's like if you get a room full of, you know, 10 C++ programmers and give them a task to do, I guarantee a lot of them what they're going to do is going to look similar to what some of the other guys are doing. And, you know, the whole software patent system can penalize you for doing something. Even if you came up with it completely on your own, if it remotely, you know, is similar to what someone has a software patent on, you can get sued and you could wind up getting having them pay back restitutions to the patent holders. It's a crazy system, and the only people that you have plenty of lawyers, you know, who are a bunch of ambulance chasers by nature, you know, ready to get the hooks into you, you know.
Right.
It's a bad thing. I really think it's a bad thing, and thank God, you know, at least Europe they're not part of that whole insanity. Okay, I'll get off my.
I actually just saw that Argentina, I think it is now in the I think it might be Argentina or
Chile, maybe.
I forget who it was. One of them said that they are abolishing, you know, software patents.
I think it was Chile.
So it's like it was it Chile. It's like in their whatever their legislative body is. It's in it now, you know, under consideration.
Good for them.
Other countries need to follow suit.
Yeah, this is something that really needs to be addressed in the United States. You know, sadly right now, the United States, the economy is in the shitter. You know, people, you know, are losing their jobs, you know, left and right. And we got bigger issues to deal with right now. But once things, you know, turn around a little bit, I really hope politicians in this country at least take a look at it and open it up again. You know, because it really needs to be reformed. It really does. It's an insanity. Right. It's a road to insanity, really. Software patents. You know, nobody wins. Except the lawyers, and screw them. I'll get off my soapbox now. Yeah, so that's that. So, Dan, I'm glad you're working on your project, man. You know, can't wait to check it out and see what you're up to. And I'll help as much as I can, you know, testing it and see what's up there.
Great, thanks. I appreciate
it. Sounds interesting.
I think it will be. By the time it's all said and done, when all the pieces are in place together, I'm hoping that it all seems to, you know, work out just the way that I have it, you know, playing out in my head. So
cool. Well, I think we're going to wrap it up. We're getting about an hour here, and we try to keep things to around an hour.
Yep.
Everybody, thanks for listening. We appreciate you taking the time to listen to us. If you have any comments or suggestions, or, you know, maybe there's a topic you want us to cover, shoot us an email. I'm Pat at the midtvcast.com. Dan, you're Dan at the midtvcast.com. You can get us on Identica
or
Twitter.
Twitter, Buzz, Facebook, whatever.
Yeah, we're
out there.
Yep.
Hit us up.
Yep. It'd be nice talking to you. So, everybody, we're going to talk to you soon. Until next time, take care.
See ya.